Good morning.
Good morning.
While we've been eating, we've been watching some less than appetizing bumper stickers flash across the screen. I wanted to give you a sampling of the not necessarily pithy slogans adorning vehicles in the United States of America today. To say the current U.S.-Mexico immigration issue evokes strong, complex, and sometimes ambiguous reactions may be an understatement. The range of responses runs on a continuum from deport all those illegal aliens and build a tall wall the entire length of the border to the south, to the view that we should open the borders, welcome undocumented immigrants, and address the related structural issues sooner rather than later. Immigration is a hot issue, and probably should be hotter. Unfortunately, it is also complicated. It's about economics, my well-being, my property, my belongings, my rights, and yours, and NAFTA. It is about who deserves to work and who deserves to get paid a living wage. It is about who should clean houses and mow yards. It is about fear that someone will take something away from me or you or us, that someone will cross the border and hurt us. It is about who is in and who is out. It is about law. It is about order. It is about how we name things like illegal, undocumented, stranger, alien, color, brown. It is about walls. It is about social services. It is about politics. It is a complicated and hot issue. So what does or should the Bible have to do with it? Some folks claim the Bible as the sole authority for their lives. Others find the Bible authoritative circumstantially. Still others see the Bible as one of a number of sources for determining the will of God. And then there are others who see the Bible as an artifact of an ancient world, holding little relevance for today's world or issues. I'd like to suggest that even those who see the Bible solely as an artifact must consider the relevance of the Bible for the United States today because of the Bible's spheres of influences in our culture and institutional structures. So, how is the Bible used in discussing immigration, and how might it be used? Those who generally see the issue as one concerning illegal immigrants and who seek to keep them out frequently make reference to a New Testament text in Romans 13. In the New Revised Standard Version, the text reads, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror of good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive its approval. For it is God's servant for your good. But if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid. For the authority does not bear the sword in vain. It is the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also because of conscience, for the same reason you also pay taxes. For the authorities are God's servants, busy with this very thing. Pay to all what is due them, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due." The predominating value drawn along this line of thought is that of the subjection of all people to the legal authority of the government. Many and excellent studies have been completed on this text, and while we do not have time for an exegetical analysis here, I would like to suggest that the hermeneutical approach resulting in subjugation to governing authorities as an absolutized value is insufficient and unhelpful with regard to the immigration issue, in much the same way it was insufficient and unhelpful in the past. We could reference many examples, but let's take just one. In his essay titled, What Belongs to Caesar? Once again, Romans 13, Alan Bosack tells the following story. Quote, on the 19th of November in 1977, I was visited for the first time by the South African security police. They stayed from 3:30 until 7. At one point, I was challenged by the security police captain, who assured me that he was a Christian and in fact an elder of the Dutch Reformed Church on my persistent resistance to the government. How can you do what you're doing, he asked, while you know what Romans 13 says? In the hour-long conversation that followed, I could not convince him. For him, as for millions of other Christians in South Africa and across the world, Romans 13 is an unequivocal, unrelenting call for blind, unquestioning obedience to the state. End quote. Romans 13 was not sufficient in that situation. Neither was Romans 13 sufficient in the face of the Holocaust. Nor was Romans 13 sufficient in addressing the issue of slavery in this country. On the other end of the spectrum, where the discussion coalesces around examining how we welcome and show hospitality to others, reference to biblical material focuses most often on verses like Leviticus 19, 33 and 34. And when a ger resides with you in your land, you will not oppress the ger. The ger will be to you as a native born among you, and you will love the ger as yourself, for you were gerim in the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. The struggles to translate ger provide an excellent case study for the hermeneutics and politics of translation within the philosophy of language, but we can't do that here today. Ger is variously and inconsistently translated into English as stranger, alien, resident alien, foreigner, guest, resident, people, resident foreigner, guests, nomads, immigrants, settler, and exiles. It's amazing. I did a chart of 10 different biblical translations, and to see how it's done is quite an interesting study. The most excellent English translation of ger is difficult to obtain in a single time and space, and even more complicated across multiple times and spaces. The variety and overlappings of selections for translation into English indicate the complications with conveying the meaning for and of ger. None of the English counterparts seem to capture the full sense of the word without some challenges. Of the possibility, sojourners carries too little meaning in today's society, often evoking a sense of the ancient. Resident alien brings mostly legal connotations. Foreigner and stranger portray the sense of otherness, but do not accurately capture living circumstances. Immigrant functions nicely for conveying alternate origins and some state of residence, but it is quite laden with political overtones in today's society. Resident might work. Its connotation differs from that of citizen. It demonstrates a particular relationship with one's locale. The Hebrew verb form of ger typically applies to definitive individuals who have departed from their home place to settle in a new land, conveying the idea of a purpose in movement. For example, Lot in Sodom, Sarah and Abraham in Egypt and Gerar, Abraham in Beersheba, Isaac in Gerar, Esau in Haran, and on and on. By contrast, 75% of the appearances of the noun ger occur in legal context. Ger appears in legal, narrative, the writings, and the prophetic material. Abraham, the progenitor of the children of Israel, serves as our first and consummate example of a ger. Abraham went forth, compelled, to a land not his own. His immigration required him to uproot everything he understood and took for granted. The biblical narrative portrays Abram the immigrant living by faith built on hope. From the moment of God's call to Abram until his death, Abraham was a ger, a picture of the people of God. Inside the Abraham narrative, we get another glimpse of a foundational ideological immigrant story. Hagar, whose name echoes Ger, according to the narrative, lived a less privileged life, multiply oppressed, circumstances dictating her choices, compelled in a different, if perhaps more desperate way, by the desires of the dominant culture. We could say Hagar was forced into the status of a Ger. The biblical narratives provide indications that people became Gerim, the plural, for compelling reasons. Hunger was a primary reason, as we see with Abraham in Genesis 12, immigrating from Canaan to Egypt, Hagar to Beersheba, Isaac to Gerar, Jacob and family to Egypt, Elimelech and family to Moab, Elijah immigrating to Sidon, the Shunammite immigrating to Philistia, all because of hunger. Other reasons in biblical narrative for immigrating include issues of personal safety, Jeroboam's fear of Solomon, Mephibosheth and his nurse for fear, Jacob for fear of Esau, and Lot to Sodom after a disagreement with Abraham. By way of the narratives, then, we see the status of Ger coming from difficult personal circumstances. But as I mentioned, most of the references to a Ger are found in the legal material, important, as you know, because of the role of legal material in the formation of society. Israel's laws function not unlike a social contract or an ideal image of how society should be. I have a chart for those of you who are interested listing the citations of Ger in the legal collections and what Ger is mentioned alongside of. You can pick it up afterwards if you'd like to have it. The essence of the laws containing Ger can be seen in these texts. You shall also love the Ger, for you were Gerim in the land of Egypt. You shall not wrong or oppress a Ger, for you were Gerim in the land of Egypt. And when a Ger resides with you in your land, you will not oppress the Ger. The Ger will be to you as a native born among you, and you will love the Ger as yourself, for you were Gerim in the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. For Yahweh is your God, God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, the mighty and the awesome, which does not show favor and does not take bribes, making justice for the orphan and widow and loving the Ger, giving them food and clothing. Cursed will be anyone who turns aside justice for the Ger, the orphan, and the widow. And all the people said, Amen. Joseph Ramirez Kidd points out three rhetorical uses of Ger in these legal collections. One has to do with how the people of God are to interact with those who have less privilege, as seen in a triad that occurs 12 times. Ger, orphan, and widow. It's not 12 times, it's more than that. I'm sorry, my parenthetical remarks to myself are off. The second has to do with the function of the native-born Ger pair, which occurs 26 times. The third has to do with the object of love. I want to suggest that these prevalent usages suggest a grounding for a biblical axiology, reflecting a fundamental value in the Hebrew Bible. First, the triad, immigrant, widow, orphan, reflects Israel's ancient Near Eastern context and more. As Norbert Lofink clearly demonstrated in Poverty in the Laws of the Ancient Near East and of the Bible, care for the misfortunate ranked higher on the ethical consciousness of ancient Near Eastern cultures than it does in modern cultures. Cultural remnants from Egypt, Syria, and Mesopotamia demonstrate such a moral obligation. In the Address to the Gods in chapter 125 of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the pertinent section reads, I have given bread to the hungry, water to the thirsty, clothes to the naked, and a boat to the boatless. In the story of Akkad, we are told that a good Canaanite king will take care of the case of the widows and defends the needs of the orphans. Another similar instance in Kirta shows this topos used in the negative, when a king did not do what was expected. You don't feed the orphan who faces you, nor the widow who stands at your back. In the prologue of the code of Ur-Nammu, who was the founder of the third dynasty of Ur, the king declares, I did not deliver the orphan to the rich. I did not deliver the widow to the mighty. I did not deliver the man with but one shekel to the man with one mina. Even the prologue to Hammurabi's code tells why the gods made him king. For the enhancement of the well-being of the people, to make justice prevail in the land, to abolish the wicked and the evil, to prevent the strong from oppressing the weak, to rise like the sun god Shamash over all humankind, and to illuminate the land. These few examples from among many provide instances of what must be regarded as a moral value in the ancient Near Eastern context. As noted, the biblical material shares this context. Interestingly, the Hebrew Bible shows one addition to the usual ancient Near Eastern list, and that is with regard to treatment of the ger. Why? Because at the core identity of these people of God was the moral imperative to respect and not oppress the ger. For you know what it is like to be a ger, because you were once ger. A fundamental value creating a mandate for care and respect of the ger. The pair native-born citizen and ger offers additional insight, appearing 26 times in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. These references appear sometimes in instructions for the community and sometimes in instructions for the priests. In most cases, these legal references instructed the people to treat the native-born and the ger with equality under the law. Deuteronomy 1:16-17 offers a nice summary. I charged your judges at that time, give the members of your community a fair hearing and judge rightly between one person and another, whether a citizen or a ger. You must not be partial in judging. Hear out the small and the great alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone, for the judgment is God's. Any case that is too hard for you, bring it to me and I will hear it. The ger deserved respect and regard under the law. A third rhetorical signification presents in the command in Deuteronomy 10:19, also seen. Whoops, I went too fast. Hold on to that. Ignore that one. 10:19, also Leviticus 19:34. You shall love the ger, for you were gerim in the land of Egypt. Consider the instances of the general command to love. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. You shall love the Lord your God, and therefore keep. Whoops, I skipped. Alrighty then. Yahweh has told you, O mortal, what is good and what does Yahweh require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. In Micah. You shall not take vengeance or bear grudge against any of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am Yahweh your God. The alien who resides with you shall be to you as a citizen among you. You shall love the alien as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. Notice the object of love in these commands. Yahweh, mercy, your neighbor, and the ger. Substantiating the importance of treatment of the ger. The key to the summary found in Deuteronomy 10:19 is the motivation clause, because you were gerim, meant to articulate the established identity of the people of Yahweh. Because you were gerim names both the past from whence they came and the future, how they are to engage their world. Love because you understand, because you were once gerim. Completing the formation of identity and ethos, these references name the Israelites as gerim before Yahweh in several citations. Scholars of the Hebrew Bible have worked for some time to show the multivocal nature of the biblical text and to demonstrate the contextual nature of biblical interpretation, often rejecting the notion of a single biblical theology. If a theological theme can be found in the Hebrew Bible, I'd like to suggest that the theology of how the people of God should treat the other rises to the top of the list of possibilities. Thank you. It's happening in many states. I was just in Indiana this week, and their legislature is doing the same thing. Also, there are 15 senators who have introduced another bill, mostly on the restrictive side on Capitol Hill. And I think it's prompted out of fear. Just this morning, a colleague shared with me an article from the New York Times on Sunday about how immigrants are welcomed into this country. It goes back to survivors of the Holocaust. I'll just read you one paragraph. An unschooled 19-year-old hoping for an education was scolded for dreaming and went to work in a factory. A newlywed couple arrived, who arrived with four pieces of baggage, mostly books, were soon forced to choose whether the husband would keep his job or keep the Jewish Sabbath. An ailing, jobless father of three faced immigration laws that called for deportation of those who sought public aid, told his caseworker, as her notes put it, that, quote, he was more concerned and more disturbed now than he had ever been in the Warsaw ghetto. We have a hard time welcoming people. Question? Yes, ma'am.
I'm interested in what you showed at the beginning. Some of us were eating and talking. Okay. I see it. I would like to see more.
Sure. What I did was just get bumper stickers from both sides. Nicholas, are you in here? I might need a little. Okay, I'm gonna do it. I can do this.
Sorry. Yeah, I could do
it. Here it is.
Thanks.
Yay, I did it. Wait, why isn't it? Okay, let's see. From beginning. Yes, okay.
Excellent. And I've noticed in some languages in Native Americans, there is not a word for enemy. There are words for stranger, but it's the same idea as in the Bible, the Old Testament, about not judging the person, letting them, giving a chance to know them before they make a decision.
If you have a chance to look for the work of a scholar from Harvard named Justine Smith, she's a PhD student doing some remarkable work about Native Americans and the whole issue surrounding immigration.
I'll ask one, and that is, you focus on the nature of this theological mandate having its origin in a motivational clause or a motivational fact, because you were once Aryan in Egypt. Would you care to speculate on Americans and their mentality of not having, is the problem that we don't have any sense that we were ever Aryan?
I don't know how to answer this in a way that's not going to just show everything I think about. I think we have disconnected ourselves so much from our history that we just think we deserve it. And we've reclaimed the history and made it our own without looking. We need the clause because you were Aryan. Yeah. Yes, Dr. Crenshaw.
Alice, how would you respond to that in terms of
thank you.
of Psalm 39, for example, which talks about the brevity of human existence and concludes by stating, look, I'm a Jair and Tosha.
Yes.
My own existence, it is only brief. I'm in a strange world. I'm an immigrant, a resident alien. It's hard, as you say, to translate those things.
It's really difficult.
But we're all Tosha.
Yes.
Or we're all here.
Yes. Why is it that we can't get that in this country? What do you think about that? Annie?
I was just going to say, I think that we, at least my generation, don't know enough about our own history that we identify as maybe white Americans, but we don't look at our European or whatever history we have, and so we disconnect from that, and there's white privilege, and I think that's what runs this whole thing. I think it's a racial thing.
I also wonder if it, this is not a well thought yet, it seems to me that the only way that ultimately persons who have less are going to have more is if those of us who have more give something up. We are not going to give something up unless we've helped people understand why there is a gift, a blessing, a joy in the giving something, which is where the church has been. Where is the blessing or the grace that is, comes as a result of sharing or giving something away to another?
The interesting piece for me is in at least what we can see from that ancient culture, that was part of life, you know? And even in some other cultures, today, for example, my mom grew up in China, and she took me back there, and I met some of the people that she grew up with. And these people have no money, but when we came, they made this huge feast welcoming us. It was a understood in their being that that's how they were to engage with us. And even though we felt badly about it, that's how it was. But we don't have that here. Or, I mean, I'm not saying everybody. I'm not talking about y'all. But.
You have Dr. Boyne from the medical field with a number of articles in the Tennessean, very relevant to issues of great importance. Last week, I think we had an article by the head of the nursing department from Vanderbilt. I don't know a full name, Conway Welch. I had a great presentation here about a year ago from the students that went to Mexico for a period of time. I would like to maybe encourage from the Divinity School articles that would be helpful to the people concerning this issue of illegal immigration. The media has really been captivated by those who have a great deal of hatred. And it's very negative. We have very, very few articles by people who can, well, like what you're doing today, in other words, bring more articles relating to the need to be godlike, Christian, whatever you want to call us, and welcome the stranger.
Yes, sir. You're right. You're right. And that's a responsibility. One of my colleagues who's sitting in this room has long called, AJ, you have four scholars to speak and not be silent in the interpretation and use of biblical material.
And as long as you're going to write these articles, Alice, because I think that's right, you might also bring in some of the New Testament material, because the New Testament appropriates the language of alien and exile, but applies it to the church. So, whereas I find very frequently when I cite Leviticus 19 about loving the ger as oneself, I get people saying, yeah, but Romans 13 says, you know, so in other words, the New Testament trumps the Old.
How do you respond to the Romans 13 piece?
Well, I tell them, according to Revelation, the government is a great whore. So it depends. go either way on that. But the fact is, the New Testament does pick up the language of alien and exile, so you can find these in the Catholic epistles. And they are illegal in their own communities. So if the church could recognize its own exilic status, its own alien status, its own illegal status, perhaps they might have a little bit more sympathy for people who are struggling in classified status.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Yes.
This is really not well thought out. I'm just sort of thinking.
Bring it on. It's
out right here. I'm wondering what the impact of the really the disappearance, continued disappearance of the middle class in our culture, how that impacts this whole issue, especially in terms of the sharing that Judy was talking about. If you've got, and I wonder as well, the core, economically poor of our culture, what their response and approach to immigration is as opposed to the fluid.
I don't think anybody's giving too much of a favorable response. For different reasons, which speaks to a larger structural issue in the society. And the question, I think, for us is how do we then get at those larger structural issues?
Did you just say that you don't think that anybody is seeing this in a positive way?
I was referring to the categories. There are, if you talk about the affluent.
The reason I ask is because when I've looked at categories of people who either favor, favor the person, the immigrant, whether they're illegal or
illegal,
or focus on illegality and throw a lot of negativity towards that. That's usually the two camps. I see that almost every group or category of people is split on this issue.
I think that's right.
So
you're not going to pick out one bad guy.
That's right. Exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Someone here just had a hand raised.
Yeah.
Yes.
As we are speculating about what the categories are, and I was very, very, I found very compelling your whole opening up of this term gator, because as a black man in America, I can say, relate to that, for you were once Gary. I can relate to that still in ways that existentially relate to it. However, you find as much antipathy antipathy in the black community on the issue of immigration as you do the white community. So I'm thinking that it may not just be an existential or psychological disconnect with that fact that we are all giving, have been giving previously. I'm thinking that maybe it is more of an economic, a capitalist issue.
Economics is a major factor in this, and yes, economics certainly, but it's also that we just don't know. I mean, I have a busy life. I don't have time to think about this. I mean, it's partially an economic issue, but even the people who take the time to learn about it find the other nuances in the argument, I think.
Oh, and I'm not saying that there aren't other nuances, but I'm saying what is that common ground or that common experience of being American? Because when I talk to other African American colleagues who are not really pro immigrant, we speak of it as though, they're coming into America, and we're Americans. We don't really break down the long racial lines. Well, we don't have a reason to be concerned, but we don't. We are Americans, and that definition of we are Americans has a very, very capitalistic economic underpinning.
Not only that, it has an identity piece to it. So it's economic, it's psychological, it's informational. But I don't think it's fair, Teddy, to generalize that all black people think a certain way about. I mean, it would make me mad, for somebody to do that to me on whatever identity you want to speak about. I mean, I think it's a complicated issue, and that's what makes this hard. So the question I'm working on and I would love help with is, how do we get at the complicated nature of this issue and actually make a difference instead of letting it become sound bites? You know, here they come into our country, you know, they're trying to take things away. I mean, how do we get beyond that?
How about dialogue between folks? How many immigrants are here today? I mean, I'm a grandchild of one, but...
Right. Two students from the Divinity School, both graduated now, Emily Snyder and Stephen Miles, started a group called Strangers No Longer. And they have a website, actually, trying to provide information to interested people about this. They went to churches to speak, to civic groups. They hosted many meetings with area clergy and immigrants and community leaders. They've done a great work. So you might check out their website if you're interested.
And on that note, my name is Tara Lentz, and a friend and I have actually sort of absorbed Emily and Stephen's work. They both graduated, and so we will be working with Strangers No Longer. So if you have questions about it, or
that's fabulous.
And I'll be going to the Divinity School kind of off.
She hasn't even started, and she's already working.
So if you have questions, please feel free to let me know. We would love
wonderful
help if your faith communities or you are interested in working with us.
Terrific.
Well, and one thing I do, and I don't know how effective it is. I mean, you can't guarantee that anything you're just going to be effective. And Moses had to call in the plagues to get his message across. But I do a website called HispanicNashville.com.
Mm-hmm.
The theory being, I just put up news about things related to Hispanic people in Nashville, so that someone who doesn't—I mean, because for me, what brought me over to—and I don't know that where I ever started anywhere else—to brought me over to a sympathy towards the immigrant or towards the Hispanic person. It's just simply getting to know them. I mean, I took Spanish. I mean, I went to a Spanish-speaking church for a while, a married woman from South America. And so in the vein that maybe lack of familiarity with the immigrant or lack of familiarity...
Was it love that motivated you? I mean... I
think love is the key to all this. Honestly, if you would love the other person sitting in front
right
of you...
But what motivated you to even think about it?
Spanish classes in high school. Once you learn to speak to a group of people, you're interested in those people and you get to know those
mm-hmm
people better. But the reason I spoke up is because I just put up news that relates to Hispanic people in Nashville, and if you ask somebody who just doesn't think about it too much about what Hispanics are doing in Nashville, they might only be able to recall a car wreck or an immigration issue, whereas if you actually looking at all the Hispanic news in town, there's a lot of different things going
yeah
on, interesting things going on,
yeah,
tango societies,
uh-huh,
people running for office,
yeah,
and so
yeah
that's just one thing I do to try to increase familiarity between
thank you
people
very
who
much
might not.
What's your website? What's the
HispanicNashville.com.
Thank you. Time.
we've arrived at the time, but there are things going on at the school already, as Tara's described. There's a Spanish mesa, a table, a language table for our students. There are more students coming to the Divinity School, I think, every year now to speak Spanish. Mostly a second language, never before. And the response to the articles and resources, watch for the forthcoming Spire, which is all about how we relate to border issues and how we relate to issues of immigration in this country. We want to wish you well this day, and to thank Dean Hunt for being interesting people.
He chose to.